Symphonia No. 1 by Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach.
This is WHFR Dearborn. Thank you for being here and for enjoying this lovely classical programming. Some other shows that you might like to try out here at WHFR include every Monday afternoon from 2 until 4 p.m. It's called Big Band with Dan, some of the greatest big band programming that you will ever want to hear, taking you back to those days gone by. Again, Big Band with Dan, Monday afternoons, 2 to 4 p.m., right here on WHFR. Also, Fridays from 10 a.m. until 1 p.m., we present The World of Big Band with Bill Wright. You'll enjoy this so much as well. The World of Big Band, Fridays, 10 a.m. until 1 p.m., right here on WHFR. And, of course, if you're tuning in for Big Band on Fridays, stay tuned for another hour in the 1 o'clock time slot. It's the new WHFR Journal. Local news and views at their best. All sorts of great programming here on WHFR. Check them out. Thanks for tuning in.
Comes to an end. As healthcare reform becomes a dinner table issue, as the rules that govern the universe are being called into question, a question comes to mind. How well do those that govern us truly understand the world in which we live? How well do the decision makers, the policy engineers, and political machines appreciate the science that surrounds the soundbites, the physics of the possible that leads to positive policy? Science, much like the following hour of programming, does not necessarily represent the views or opinions of the University of California, Davis, KDVS, or its sponsors. Science is present in almost every issue before our leaders. It is understanding of science that is required to chart the correct course for the future. Yet, it is an understanding of science that our leaders so often seem to lack. While this lack of understanding is still standing, we will continue to rely upon the underinformed decisions of poorly prepared political perceptions that rely on ideology rather than reality, on think tanks rather than trained thinkers. Can we do better than this? Yes, of course we can. And we can start by lobbying our leaders to listen to This Week in Science, coming up next.
I've got the kind of mind that can't get enough. I wanna learn everything. I wanna fill it all up with new discoveries that happen every day of the week. There's only one place to go to find the knowledge I seek. I wanna know what's happening.
Good morning, Kirsten.
Good morning, Justin. Oh, my, is my button What's going on?
I can't hear. Are you here? Are we here?
Am I here this morning? Yes.
Good morning.
What's going
More
on
This
here?
Week in Science. It's Tuesday, August 25th.
It is.
2009. How did that happen?
I have no idea. More than halfway through the year, we've got science, and an interview today. Yes, with Richard Mueller from UC Berkeley, who's written Physics for Presidents, which I believe is going to be coming out
as a
book this September. In the meantime, it's a lecture series
at
Berkeley. Lecture,
it's a bunch of information that it's sort of like if you boil down all that's known in science, or all that's known in physics, what are the few things that every president should know going into looking at policy and anything else, or just in general knowledge even? What stuff that's going to affect the lives of man from the policy perspective in science?
What will from science
that
affect
most likely
the lives of man? I love that.
Most likely is unknown. I mean, there's no science quiz. And anything of getting elected to president or any other political position, they don't ask you basic questions in science. It just doesn't come up in any of the, you know.
No, there's no quiz.
Right. There's no science quiz. So, I mean, it's almost like if you are wanting to be president, the message it sends to the youth, anyway, is that if you want to be president, there's no need to take any science classes.
Oh, no.
Mm-mm.
No, all you have to do is have a nice smile.
Maybe.
People must trust you.
Pay attention in that 8th grade hygiene class. Get close attention to the grooming tips that your PE coach gives you.
Look good on camera.
And
have a nice sound bite. That's all you need. But we're going to be talking with Dr. Mueller about what kinds of science, what kinds of physics are really necessary for people who might like to go into politics, potentially becoming a future president, and hopefully generally about his research and about science education and literacy in the public. I'm going to ask him about Nemesis. Nemesis.
Does he have one?
I believe he does. And additionally, in this hour of This Week in Science, I have stories about worms, bacteria, and time. Mm. Time. Moving forward.
Moving backward?
Nope.
Moving sideways?
Nope. Doesn't go backwards. Doesn't go sideways. It only goes forward. Why is that? Why?
I don't know. I'm not convinced that it does, but I believe you for now.
Yeah.
What do I got? I have no idea. Oh, I've got misnomers, myths, and common misperceptions about the current healthcare plan. I've got, let's see, what else is in here?
That could fill up an entire show. I don't know about that.
That's
one, Justin.
That's a long one. That's like going to be my whole rant this morning.
Ranty science policy.
Yeah, and then there's other stuff, but I can't find it. Where's all my paper? I printed more than this.
I don't know.
Oh, yeah, and this one's, I could almost, by telling the headline, I give away this story, so I'm not going to.
All right, don't do it. It's the mystery story coming up from Justin. So, starting everything off, let's get going with how the J. Craig Venter Institute is at it again.
Dun, da, da, da.
Dun, da, 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 da. Yeah, those are like French horns or something, but not. So, Craig Venter, his institute, the researchers there are really into some interesting stuff. In their search for the minimalist genome, they're trying to design the smallest genome possible, synthetically. Like put DNA together in such a way that the smallest number of base pairs will allow life to function.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the most minimal genome needed for life? And that's a big question they're after. In the meantime, they're really interested in synthesizing life. So being able to put DNA together, pull it out of one bacteria, put it into another bacterium, and then maybe throw it into something else that'll make it copy out, put it in another bacterium, and suddenly you have bacteria that are creating biofuels, and they're doing it efficiently and quickly and much faster than if you were just using the regular old bacteria that have been used.
The kind you found in your bathroom.
Right. So maybe we can. Yeah, maybe we can take bacteria and make them better for our needs. It's possible.
I can see the mad scientist coming out in Kirsten right now. She's actually doing the little fingery, plotty, planny thing where they.
I know. So research in 2008, and actually very early in this, I think it was 2008, and very early in this year, January, we heard from the Venter Institute with some work they had been doing in transferring DNA from one species of bacteria into a second species of bacteria, and thereby making the second species of bacteria pretty much like the first species of bacteria. Now, though, one of the goals is to be able to use tools that have been developed in yeast species. So yeast, it's not even just the difference between bacteria and yeast. These are completely different families. So like nucleus, no nucleus.
Right.
You know, we're dealing with two. We're when you start dealing with yeast, you're dealing with the branch of life that includes humans.
Yes, we're over there.
I mean, very far removed from yeast, but you know, that's our branch of life, and so we're going from one branch of life and putting DNA from one branch of life into an organism of the other branch of life. And then what they did is that, oh, we've got these great tools to play with yeast. We're going to fix it up. We're going to make it reproduce a lot, and we're going to take all that DNA. And then they took it, and they put it back in bacteria. Mm. And so why they did this is basically there have been tons of tools produced by microbiologists to work with yeast and to mess around, play with the DNA of yeast to that there's a greater understanding and usefulness of yeast than there currently is in bacteria. Bacteria, there's still a lot that we don't know, and we can't really play with them as easily as the yeast. Mm. And so this is a really great step forward by the Venter Institute, being able to take the DNA from the bacteria, put it into the yeast, insert genes into places where they want genes to be inserted, to be able to give functionality where there was not functionality before, and then put it in and also increase the reproductiveness so that you can actually produce lots and lots and lots of whatever gene it is that you want to be increasing the usefulness of, like one for producing the byproducts that go into biofuels, and then put it back into another species of bacteria that can then be used in, say, biofuel tanks. But then suddenly they are much more efficient and effective at creating that byproduct than the original bacterial species was. So this is a really amazing step forward. They're not quite to the point of creating life from scratch, but what they've done here is really neat. They got the bacterial DNA into the yeast by adding a centriole, a particular component of the yeast DNA or chromosomal structure that allowed it to not be attacked and broken apart by the yeast's immune system defenses. Mm. Yeah, so basically it was like trying to get past the defenses of the yeast and to get it to be incorporated into the yeast DNA. That was the hard step, and now they've made it past that. You know, adding sugars, making the bacterial DNA all pretty, and so the yeast go, oh, a present for me! Yay! So this is pretty neat. Very neat. Big step forward.
Pretty awesome stuff. And the thing, too, is if you can engineer a bacteria properly, you can go into your body and it can make you better. It can make your digestive system better.
Oh, like if potentially.
Most bacteria are beneficial. There's tens, thousands of species in the human body that all have some little function. Well, most of them have a little function that helps us digest things and do things properly. The one I would predict that they should shoot for is the skinny bacteria.
The skinny bacteria, right?
Forget the Superfund sites. We can handle those. We don't need one to
create. We want a bacteria.
Superfuel? No, we'll figure out a different way.
We want one that really you can take as a probiotic that will digest the fats.
It cleans up the fat in the system. Skinny bacteria. That's the one.
All right.
They should concentrate.
That's an idea.
In the meantime, the old methods of doing things for our digestive system, for our tracts, this is one for a tract, may not actually be as efficient and as useful as the old wives' tale, the home remedy, as seeming to have been convincing us over the years. Cranberry juice! In clinical trials, failed to have any real impact in combating urinary tract infections.
Although that's what people think that it does.
Well,
As long as I can remember, it's like, oh, drink cranberry juice, drink cranberry juice.
Yeah. Anytime you have a urinary tract infection, which I think is kind of it's a female problem. Am I wrong? I've never heard of a guy being like, yeah, I've got a urinary tract infection. I've never heard that.
It happens.
It may happen, but I've never heard it come from a guy.
It is very often. It is an affliction of the female sort.
Yeah. It's more a vagina issue, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, but they went and they've studied it, and there are lots of compounds in there, and they were trying to figure out what might be responsible for the therapeutic effect. So they did these studies where they broke it down and did all. Basically, it was inconclusive at best. The best results they could come up with were inconclusive. A lot of them ranged down in the completely unsatisfactory and didn't really seem to be. However, you know, drinking lots of liquids to flush a system doesn't sound like a bad strategy.
So was that, I mean, is that one of the things that they tested, just generally lots of liquids? Was that part of it?
Nope.
Nope. Okay.
But I'm just saying that sounds like it would be a good strategy.
Which is what I've
lots
always
of water.
Thought is probably how the cranberry juice, I mean, if you're just drinking, it's not the cranberry in the cranberry juice necessarily.
Then why cranberry juice? Why not just drink lots of fluids?
Lots of water. Drink lots of fluids. I think it's the fluids. There was also this idea that I don't know how many studies have been done to this point, but echinacea in echinacea supplements, even in like juices, mm-hmm. would help. And there's some nice brands of juice with echinacea added to them. But really, it's not the echinacea that's helping. It's the fact that you're drinking a ton of water and you're really hydrating yourself and that and getting vitamins and minerals that you maybe weren't necessarily doing before because you were drinking coffee and you were, you know, not taking care of yourself, but suddenly you're sick and you're, oh, I need to take care of myself.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a change in behavior that takes place.
But just there's also, oh, they found potential side effects, and they did do some, they did do a bunch of different doses and formulations and sort of did the range. They said potential side effects of cranberry juice in some of these included upset stomach and weight gain.
Mm. Yeah, because it's an increase in calories, especially if you're drinking cranberry juice with sugar added.
Wow.
You're increasing your caloric intake. Fascinating. These are the little things that people do not think of.
So, yeah. Well, that's one myth down.
Shut down. Whoa.
Sorry about that.
I am a target. I'm a target, but not for the green bombers.
Huh?
The green bombers that were found deep under the ocean surface.
Ooh.
Scientists publishing in the journal Science from Scripps Oceanography have found little tiny worms that they've decided to call the green bombers.
Green bomber worms? What?
Green bomber worms.
In the ocean?
Yeah, they're found between about 6,000 and 12,000 feet deep. I mean, it's pretty deep. So that's a very dark area of the ocean, and in the dark, bioluminescence often will help out organisms out with behavioral finding of each other or interacting with others of their own or other species. Now, these green bombers, however, their bioluminescent displays are actually these little they've derived from the gills of the worms. So the gills which would in other species that they probably evolved from would have been used for filter feeding and for getting oxygen or whatever nutrients are necessary. These worms have changed up the function of those little gills and turned them into little green bioluminescent bombs that they drop.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Where do they drop them on?
I don't think they drop them on anything, but what I would assume is that they allow, they're probably a distraction.
Oh, right.
So that
right,
if they're,
right.
I mean, maybe it's a countermeasure.
Yeah.
Maybe it's some, I mean, I don't, this is something they still have a lot of research to do with these organisms to figure out exactly what the behaviors are that, you know, the conditions that this worm is faced with on near the sea floor, what may cause them to act in this way, to drop their little green bombs. But they're neat. They're fluids, bioluminescing fluid-filled spheres that when they're dropped, that's when they turn on and they luminesce. So I would assume that they drop them, the light turns on, and then the worm can get away, and
right.
whatever's after the worm could go after the little bombs.
Right.
But you know, maybe that's not what it is, but
that's just how our jet planes, like, avoid heat-seeking missiles. They fire off these little heated decoys that the missile then tracks instead of the fighter plane.
Yeah.
It's all just – nothing that we do isn't just nature repeating.
Yeah, the researchers want to figure out – I mean, the gills in related species, the gills that have not turned into the green bombs, they detach very easily also. So maybe this has been like some kind of stepwise process into developing the little green bombs. But that's something that these researchers are really interested in figuring out. How do you evolve – little green bombs that you drop. How does that happen? Bombs away!
Oh my goodness, that is pretty wild.
And the other thing from this Eureka Alert article, the researchers said that they actually didn't see the bombs being dropped when they were in their submersible vehicle under the water because the lights are so bright.
Right, they got this.
That they just washed it out, didn't see them, but they collected them and then got them back to the lab, and that's when they ended up noticing the little green bombs being dropped. So this was something that hasn't been noticed really before because of the technology that we're using.
Or maybe it's just their way of communicating to other worms.
Maybe.
Like message in a bottle.
I mean, how hard is it? Do you only have two green bombs and that's your lifetime supply? Or do they grow back easily? What is the cost to carrying these bombs and dropping them? You know, how hard is that decision for a worm to go, I've got to drop my only supply? Yeah, I think it's fascinating.
Okay, ranty times.
Oh, dear.
Healthcare stuff.
Ah!
This is just a random sample that was conducted here by the University Center for Health Policy and Professionalism Research, Indiana. They were kind of looking at what people's impressions are of this, what's becoming a healthcare plan, this formation thing. And some of the stuff that's out there in the media is or being debated or asked is kind of interesting. One of the things that I keep hearing a lot about is the government will determine when the old people have to die.
Oh, yeah.
They say, okay, it's now time.
That's not going to happen.
Yeah. However, even though that's the one that I've heard like the most repeated, only 3 out of 10 Americans actually believe that. Like, we're not convinced at all.
Nobody's convinced, even though the media tells us that we're convinced.
It keeps showing up in the media. Oh, we have a call.
We have a call.
Good morning, Twist Minion. You're on the air with This Week in Science.
Oh, hi. This is Pia from Denmark.
Oh.
Pia from Denmark?
Thank you for calling in.
I just wanted to say I'm a big fan of your show. I listen to it on the podcast.
Oh, wow. Thank you so much. How amazing that you're calling us.
Yeah.
That's very cool.
I'm hearing you right now, actually. I just added you to iTunes.
Wonderful.
I'm a mammoth.
I just heard the show about Darwin's birthday. You said that Iceland and Denmark was the two countries that believed the most in evolution.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Really doesn't surprise me, but yeah. I just think that's cool. So.
Yeah, you came out way ahead. What is it?
Way
ahead. What do you think it is? What's the difference there than what you've seen or heard of America?
Oh, I can't even.
We can't be insulted if that's.
I really think it's terrifying sometimes when you hear stories about the United States. Sorry.
We scare the world.
Doesn't it seem like a less civilized place than it really should be? Sometimes.
It does, but you help it a great deal, so.
Thank you.
You do. I was thinking about, do you follow the Climidia, the conference, Climidia conference we're going to have here in Copenhagen.
Really?
This year.
Excellent.
That's right.
Yeah.
Excellent.
The Climidia conference.
Are they actually calling it that? Because then I would just be totally, I'd have to get a ticket.
I know.
No, I don't. But, yeah. keep that in mind.
I haven't followed it, but I will. I'll start tracking it. I'll see. I'll get some info on it.
Yeah, we haven't had it. We haven't had a good chlamydia update recently, so it might be. It might be worth getting into. Thank you so much for calling.
Talk
this is
that.
Great.
Thanks to you, so.
Yeah, talk. Cheers. Have a good, great evening.
yeah, have a good morning.
Thank you. Bye. Bye, Pia. Wow, Pia from Denmark. Wow.
Calling in. All the way from Denmark. That's awesome.
They have better health care.
They do. They have.
But they also pay more taxes. So, I mean, there is a balance, and that's something that is a question.
But here's,
and this
here's
isn't
the deal.
A scientific issue.
No,
that's
no.
That's a money. How do you allocate your resources issue?
I can pretend this is relativity for a moment and say that things being relative. I spent a little time in Denmark, and one of the things I noticed was, yeah, taxes are like 50%.
Right.
Which is like a heart attack, right?
It's, yeah.
But the minute, I mean, like, what people were making was like double.
Right.
Like on average people were making here, like minimum wage was twice as much, and then all the workers were making, and then healthcare is free, and then housing prices were lower, and automobiles cost like what a house cost, but a house cost what like a car cost. I mean, it was everything was reversey. It's a different economics. You can't compare. You can't be like, oh, the taxes are too high. Well,
everything's different.
If everything else you're not paying for is coming cheaper or working out for you. Standard of living is what it comes down to. Standard of living, not what your tax rate is, not how many.
Right. Yeah. Do you have a good standard of living?
Can you afford your rent?
And then there's also research that's come out. Is it Denmark also that, or one of the Scandinavian countries that where people are the happiest, where they've psychologically judged what happiness is and.
Correct. Yeah.
Scandinavians are pretty darned happy.
They're really high up there. But also they drink more than anybody else. So maybe that's it. Maybe I don't know. I'm just saying that. I don't really. So, okay.
They're making up for that, you know, half a year of darkness.
They don't have half a year of darkness.
I'm kidding.
They're so far below the Arctic.
I know.
Maybe the Norwegians or the Finns.
The Norwegians have a lot of.
Maybe some of those far northerners.
Yeah.
But the Greenlanders, they definitely, if you go up there.
Yeah.
So. Roughly six. Oh gosh, this list is just. I mean, that was my favorite. Most of this stuff is actually pointing out that Americans believe a lot of these myths. 67% believe that there's going to be additional wait times for healthcare. 6 out of 10 believe taxpayers will pay for abortions. That's not part of it. Those are the misconceptions that you would expect that have always been around, sort of.
Right.
But I love the 3 out of 10 Americans that believe that only 3 out of 10 have bought into the. Telling old people when to die Kool-Aid.
That's good. I like that.
Yeah.
That gives me hope. There was actually a really interesting article that someone sent me last week relating to this in a way where they actually looked at people's perceptions and how people basically trick themselves, find evidence to support whatever it is that they want to believe. So if you want to believe that healthcare is going to become worse, you're actually going to find all sorts of evidence to support that, whether or not it's true, whether or not that evidence. I mean, the people will actually go to great lengths to fool themselves, just to make themselves happy in their or firmer in their own beliefs.
A great example of that is the debate about whether or not it's going to put private healthcare out of work, and one side will point to. Say, hey, you know, you can compete with the government. Look at FedEx. Look at UPS. They compete fantastically. The other side of that argument is like, yeah, look at how great FedEx and UPS are. Look at how, you know, how the post offices run. So then both sides have excellent points at the same on the same issues.
On the same
issues. And can find
issues.
Whatever side that they want to.
I think that, yeah.
Either I think the post office is awesome, personally. I can put 50 cents on a piece of paper and they'll send it anywhere.
Anywhere. It goes anywhere.
Hand walk it to somebody's door and put it right there. Brilliant.
Oh, my goodness. Get a couple minutes left here before the end of the hour. Why does time only move forward? A study or a theoretical paper that was published, I believe, in archive.org by Lorenzo Maccone. Basically, what he's figured out is that entropy, because of entropy, which is the decay of a system, so the move to chaos, you can never move backwards. And so because of the fact that we are observing things, and because of our observant perspective, and we've seen things become a certain way, for time to move backwards, we would have to erase our memory and erase, you know, the memory of others that have observed something take place, and observe what it was that took place. We'll have to decay backwards to it, or we'll have to go back to its original state. So there is really no way within our closed system of a universe throughout the entire universe to be able to reduce the entropy and to with that. So what an Ars Technica author has said is that running time in one direction allows records to be kept and events to be observed. In the other direction, observation becomes impossible. So although time could be running in either direction, it's only possible for any observer to experience it in the forward direction. So time moves forward because of the fact that we observe it. Because of the fact that we are paying attention, because any
okay,
and so it doesn't have to be human. We don't have time to discuss this. We can.
but the opposite of that is, if you're going backwards, you always know what's happening next. I mean, how bizarre is it? I don't know what's going to happen now. How is that any more weird than not remembering what just happened? I don't understand. Like, I know exactly what's going to happen for the rest of my life. I know how it's going to play out, and I can't wait for it to happen. Versus, I have no idea. I mean, this building could blow up any second. I don't know the future. That's scary.
You don't know the future.
That's all unrecorded.
But we're going.
Like, it's the same. No, I don't buy it.
You don't buy it?
There's no difference.
All right. Well, maybe there is a difference. Hopefully, maybe this is something that Dr. Mueller can comment on.
Maybe.
He's, I don't know. He's more into things like.
He's going to be more nuts
extra,
and bolts physics.
Extra. He's more into extra suns orbiting our sun. So, yeah, well, who knows? It's what we're going to talk to him about. So we will be back in just a few moments with more This Week in Science and Physics. Enjoying today's show, if you learned something new, or if you would just like to support our attempt at infotaining you, feel free to donate to the podcast by visiting www.twis.org and clicking on the donate button. Donations of any size are always welcome. Thank you for listening.
This miracle cure leaves no permanent pain. Still,
you can't believe what a skeptic I am.
I can't believe you believe in that plan.
We disagree, but
I still give a damn.
We're back with more This Week in Science.
That's right, and on the line we have Dr. Richard Muller. He's a professor of physics at University of California, Berkeley, past winner of the Genius Award, the MacArthur Fellowship.
I'm still waiting to
I know.
Be nominated.
That's the knock on your door, Justin. It's and he's also...
not opportunity. I know that knock. I'm not answering.
He's the creator of the lecture course at UC Berkeley, Physics for Future Presidents, which has been turned into a book. And without any further ado, let's bring Dr. Muller on the line.
Dr. Muller, welcome to This Week in Science.
Delighted to be here.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us. We've been enjoying your lectures on YouTube.
No, thank you.
You're welcome. I think it's fabulous that you and the university have made, you know, a lecture course, which is normally available to those in the classroom, available to anyone with the ability to download them.
Well, it's actually an enormous pleasure for a teacher to suddenly have so many more people learning. It's something we aspire to do, and I had never imagined when we started this that I would reach so many people in so many different countries even.
Yeah, what kind of a response have you gotten so far?
Well, it's been enormous. At first, I thought it would be mostly my students who couldn't make a lecture. And then I started getting email from around the U.S., and now, after a while, I started keeping track of the number of different countries of people who called and who sent email of appreciation. And it's up to 88 countries now.
Wow.
It's really amazing.
So this is really a course that initially, you know, had, you know, the hope that it would affect just a few people, now has a global reach. This is really exciting.
Well, what's really nice is how appreciative the emails are. People in countries who say they couldn't get this kind of education, they're so pleased to be able to get the same material that students at the University of California are getting. I get retired people. I get janitors who listen to this. They listen to the iPod version of it while they're working, and even a soldier in Iraq, a couple of soldiers in Iraq. So it's really a great reward for me.
Absolutely, but what I find funny, and I've heard this from a few people who've put their work out there, you know, their classroom out there online on either the iTunes and the YouTube. I think it must be that professors for too long have seen the large percentage of sort of blank stares from students who are too early in the morning, who they don't realize how much what they're teaching can really be appreciated.
It's funny. I think a lot of students don't realize professors are looking right at their faces.
Right.
They're telling you this the whole time.
Or their smiles. If the professor keys off that, then it's like a conversation where you respond to the student. The student's not necessarily saying anything. They may raise their hand now and then. But if you keep your eye on their faces, you can do a better job.
Right.
Because you can play off of how people are responding and be able to know how to explain it better.
That's right. You see when they understand it. You can look at a student's face and they're letting you know when they're confused. And at that point, you might change the approach and explain it differently. Then you see that little glimmer of understanding on their face, and you realize you've done something.
What do you think it is about Physics for Future Presidents, excuse me, that is really capturing people's attention? What did you design the course for, and is it doing what you wanted it to do?
Yeah, and it took me some while to do this, but the real key thing is that the students recognize what they're learning is clearly important. They know these are things that they need to know, whether it's to vote or just to discuss things with their friends. My thought was that with really one semester course, mm-hmm. You can't teach all physics, obviously.
No.
So I decided to simply eliminate everything that wasn't obviously important. Even so, I have too much material. But my feeling is if the student listens to a lecture and says, why do I need to know that? Then I failed as a professor.
Mm. Right. Do you think that that people are able to go away after your course and intelligently discuss or have opinions on, science policy issues that might affect them? I mean, I've heard, you know, maybe there are criticisms from people, you know, who would like a more in-depth, in-detail, math-oriented course where they really get into the nitty-gritty. I mean, by eliminating that part of the material, do you think that people really do go away with a good enough view to have a view that's educated?
I don't think I get rid of the nitty-gritty, and
okay.
I don't think this course is a survey course.
Right.
I give an example. A student of mine who had dinner with her family, she came back to see me because she had to tell me the story about how they had a physicist over from Livermore.
Wow.
And the physicist was regaling them with stories of controlled thermonuclear fusion. At the end, she said, I think solar power has a great future, too. And he, in a typical impolite physicist way, laughed, as she said, and said, if you want enough solar power just for the state of California, he said, you'd have to plaster the whole state with solar cells.
Not true.
Well, her answer there was, no, your numbers aren't right. There's a gigawatt of power at noon in a square kilometer of sunlight. And that's the same as a nuclear power plant.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
And she said he was silent for about 20 seconds until he finally said, well, your numbers don't sound wrong. I'll have to look at that again. Now I ask you, who had the greater depth of knowledge? My student after one semester or the physicist from Livermore who was working on thermonuclear fusion?
Right.
I can give you lots of examples like this of people who actually have this depth. The sorts of things that I teach are things that most physics majors don't know. They don't know how nuclear weapons work. They don't understand global warming. Mm-hmm. They don't understand new energy technologies because they're so busy learning the math. If you mistake math with depth, then you're really making a fundamental mistake of what physics is about.
Yeah, I agree with you there. So from there, I'd like to just jump really quickly to the way that physics and science is taught in general. And the fact that we wait so long, you know, for students to get the math before they're taught physics, do you think that students would have any different understanding or just a different science literacy by the time they get out of school if physics were approached first from a conceptual level and then brought upward through chemistry and then biology and then maybe
grade?
Yeah.
Get it in there early. You know?
I do believe that physics is badly taught because there's too much of an emphasis on mathematics. I think that's a fault of our profession. I think it's a mistake. I really regret, for example, the fact that the best physics students now take AP physics, in which all they do is get an introduction to a little bit of physics with a lot of math. And this is supposedly depth. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the non-AP courses, you will learn about a lot of things. You will learn about the flow of water. You will learn about airplanes flying. You'll learn about heat and so on, which the AP course typically doesn't take. So I think there is a mistake that we've made in thinking, in associating physics with math. By the time a student gets to be a graduate student, the typical physics professor knows you have to beat the math out of them. they want to answer every question by writing an equation. And the professor says to them, no, just stop and think. Think physics. And right. And so we know at the advanced level, there's a way of thinking physics that's not mathematical. A lot of students never learn that. They go off into some mathematical realm of physics, become great mathematicians, but not really don't do that much physics. Wow. You look at the great discoveries of physics, it's people have this physical feeling for what's going on. And we're missing out on that. And I think that's a mistake we've made as a profession, in large part, I think, because it's easier to teach the math. The physics professors enjoy the math aspect of it. But I don't think that's what physics education really is. My students know all sorts of things that physics majors haven't learned.
Maybe there's too many math teachers teaching physics at the lower level.
Well, I'm not sure. I think math is a refuge. You know, if a student asks a question about how a solar cell works, the professor will say, "Well, let me write an equation." It's a good way to avoid answering the question. I've never come across. I believe that all physics questions can be answered without having to mention differential equations or integral calculus or group theory or anything like that. Basically, physics is physics, and math is a tool. An architect, when asked about how to design a house, it doesn't really have to talk about chainsaws and nails and screws. You know, talk about the house and what it is, not how it was made. And a lot of, you know, anybody who has learned physics may not be able to work out all the equations, but you could always hire a physics professor if you need that.
Or a mathematician, right. Now, you have moved, like, you are a professor of physics, and you started out in particle physics and have moved to larger objects. I'm really curious to know about the nemesis idea. This is something, I mean, I get questions all the time from people. Oh, you know, 2012, are the solar flares is that going to change everything? Is that the end of the Mayan calendar and blah, 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 you know, all these coinciding dates and Planet X is in there. And there are this little tiny voice in the background. There's some people go, nemesis.
Right. Nemesis isn't yet forgotten.
No.
It was a theory that I coined the term nemesis back in 1984 when we saw a peculiar pattern in the way extinctions happened on the Earth. They occurred every 26 million years. So I worked with several people about this. I had the idea that maybe there's a star orbiting the sun at a light year distance. I knew enough about astronomy to know it would not have been found. The usual ways of finding nearby stars are that they're passing by at high speed, so you see them move. But this would be out there and near the end of its orbit. So I suggested, I and a couple of my colleagues wrote a paper about this, suggesting that everything in the pattern of extinctions could be understood if there was this companion star, which we thought would not have been discovered. In fact, I think subsequently most people now agree that such a star would not have been discovered. So it still could be out there explaining things. But since we haven't found it since 1984, a lot of astronomers think the theory was disproven. Mm. The fact is, it's just really hard to find. But I think it's a good chance we'll find it in the next 5 years, because there are survey telescopes being put together now that are going to measure the distance to every star down to quite low magnitudes. And it's bound to pop up there. So I'm optimistic that if the sun does have a star, it's a theory. It would mm-hmm. explain things, but there are other ways to explain it. If the sun does have a companion star at this distance, so that it doesn't look very bright, it just looks like another star, that we will find it in the next 5 years.
And so is the idea then that the close pass of this orbiting star would have an effect on with radiation, or would it be in dragging
comets
and meteorites?
The numbers worked out very nicely. A close passage of the star, it doesn't have to come very close, a half a light year, a quarter light year, it's plenty close, would disturb the comets that are out in the outermost, actually it's called the Oort comet cloud.
Yeah.
It would disturb them in such a way that their orbits would be changed, and typically one or two or three of them would then hit the Earth. That worked out so neatly, so nicely. We didn't have to adjust any parameters. We didn't have to invent any new mechanisms. If this companion star, if it existed, would send every 26 million years several comets into hitting the Earth. So that was the nice part of the theory. It really worked out. So, and it fit right in with what the Alvarezes had discovered, namely that the great catastrophe 65 million years ago came about when some object, a comet or an asteroid, hit the Earth. So it fit right into that pattern, and that's why I'm still somewhat optimistic that we will find this star.
That'd be very interesting, because I think a lot of people, because we've found so many objects, I mean, we know the planets in our solar system, we know the Kuiper belt, we know the Oort cloud, we are aware of these things, we're aware of stars with planets orbiting them light years away from us. So how is it possible that we couldn't have noticed something orbiting our own sun?
Things are really hard.
Yeah.
It's orbiting very slowly, 26 million years, so it's not moving very fast.
Right.
It's moving with us because it's part of the solar system, so it just looks like a stationary star out there. And most things we see that are stationary out there are far away.
Mm-hmm.
It's as if you are in a train and the window isn't moving with you. You don't even realize you're moving until you look outside. So this is moving with us. And so it would just look like a distant star. Most stars in our galaxy are quite dim. The red dwarf star is the most common, and a red dwarf at a distance of one or two light years would be too dim to be seen without a pair of binoculars. So it's very possible that this thing is out there and we never would have seen it. But we'll find out. In the end, fortunately, it's a testable theory, and I think with these surveys, if it's not found when these surveys are completed, then the theory was wrong.
Right. And as long as you're willing to go, okay, there's some other explanation.
Right. There's a theorem I love in physics, which if something happens, it must be possible.
That's
good. I know on your website you have a list of your theorems.
Yes.
Which there are some of them that are quite humorous. I enjoyed reading that. What else are you working on right now? I mean, you're teaching. What areas of research are you really, really digging into?
Well, my main interest in the last few years has been in climate change. I spent 10, 12 years researching the history of climate change, the ice ages, analyzing data, getting new data from the glaciers, analyzing that, trying to understand what's going on. The irony is we understand fairly well that the ice ages in the past have come about by changes in the orbit of the planet Earth. That's very interesting. But the issue of the recent climate change is much more difficult because it's so subtle. And according to the scientific consensus, the IPCC, there's been really a climate change of about 2 degrees Fahrenheit in the last 150 years.
Mm-hmm.
Half of that, according to the IPCC, is probably, more than half of that, is probably caused by natural causes, but there's some residual we can't explain away, a fraction of a degree Fahrenheit that we believe must be due to humans. And what does that mean for the future? What does that mean for alternative energy? This has become my main focus now for the last couple of years.
What do you think the best, right now people are split. There is the controversy between, you know, people believing that climate change is caused by humans or not caused by humans. And regardless of that, there is, you know, change occurring, and that's something that most people do agree on. So I think the push right now is on finding solutions. What do you think are the most, the best solutions that we could possibly put our resources into right now?
Well, I think the problem we have right now is that no matter what the United States does, if the world doesn't follow, if the world doesn't adopt some way of reducing carbon, that it's very likely that we will have, I think, a very uncomfortable amount of global warming. And the problem here is the U.S., because we're a wealthy country, tend to do this by doing expensive things, you know, battery-driven automobiles that cost $120,000. Makes us feel good, we spend money, but that will never be adopted by China and India. They can't afford things like that. And in the end, most of the carbon that's going to be emitted is going to come from China, India, and the developing world.
Right.
So unless we develop technologies that are inexpensive, we're not solving the problem. We're just, I fear that so many of my colleagues feel, hey, I'm putting in compact fluorescent lights. In fact, I did that myself.
Uh-huh.
Hey, I'm driving a Prius. Hey, I'm doing that myself. This is sort of like giving a quarter to a beggar who's starving.
Yeah, it's not going to change their life.
These are not solutions that will solve the problem.
Yeah.
The problem is we need solutions that the developing world can afford to implement. I'm optimistic about solar power for that reason. I see the price of solar power, of certain kinds of solar power, not all kinds, but certain kinds of solar power, I don't really see what the floor is on the price that's dropping. I'm optimistic about wind power. Nuclear power, I'm completely optimistic about the safety of that and the waste storage. I don't see any technical problems there. A little bit worried about the price. Can we get the price of that down
yeah.
to where it's competitive? So I think there are some. The biggest one, of course, is energy conservation. That's something that really can be adopted by any country simply because it's profitable. If you invest in energy conservation, even in your own home, you'll get a 15-20% return on your investment, and people don't appreciate that. Mm. It's really the best thing you can do. There are things like cool paints, cool roofs that reduce the need for air conditioning. There's better insulation for the winter. There's better fuel efficiency for automobiles. These things are such money makers
mm-hmm.
that. What we really need is to share this technology as much as possible with the developing world. The developing world turns out to be extremely inefficient in its use of energy, and that's okay. We were inefficient, too, when we were developing, but that's where the big hope is, I think. That plus solar, wind. There's some things I'm not enthusiastic about, like geothermal, but there are things that are really good.
And
the geothermal, I mean, when I heard that can actually lead to earthquakes, there's some potential of earthquake in that?
No, not really.
Really?
that's a little more science fiction.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah, I believe there's one geothermal installation that's potentially going to be going into the North Bay somewhere. There's an area that is ripe for potential earthquakes, but it's also mm-hmm. great for geothermal activity, and there were
yeah.
some earthquakes
there some,
in, like, Switzerland.
There's an area called geysers, which has yeah. traditionally been very good. Iceland depends a lot on geothermal. Whenever the Earth concentrates geothermal by bringing the heat together to one spot, then you have a real potential. The problem is that, on average, geothermal is so diffuse. If you compare overhead sunlight, for example, when the sun is overhead, you're getting a kilowatt in a square meter. if you ask how much heat is coming up from the Earth, obviously it's less, right? You don't feel the ground being hot. You feel the sun coming down. Mm-hmm. It's a factor of 10,000 less.
Wow, that's a lot.
That's it's hard to extract energy out of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if the Earth concentrates it for you in a volcano or a geothermal area, a nice benign one, like at the geysers, or at Yellowstone, there's some places in Australia, Iceland is famous for this. If the Earth concentrates it for you at no cost to you, then it's great.
We're just wrapping up our show now. I'm wondering if there's one major issue that you think is going to be the big issue that future presidents are going to be up against that will require physics knowledge.
Well, I think the big issue these days is climate change and alternative energy. I talk a lot about that in my book, which about a third of the book is devoted to that. So I try to cover everything we haven't had time to cover here today. But right. I think the national security of the United States in the future is going to be determined by our energy needs and by the requirement that we do this cleanly. With the biggest solution being higher efficiency and energy conservation, but these other technologies coming around. I think this is the big national security issue for the future.
I think I've got the answer. I think we've seen one run of it that was a test run that was pretty successful. I think I actually have the answer for cleaning up the environment in the U.S.
Yeah?
Yeah. Bikes for clunkers.
Bikes for clunkers.
That would do it, right?
Yeah, all the trucking.
This was a halfway attempt. This was actually a more expensive attempt at doing it. But this the way they just did it. But bikes for clunkers, that could actually do it.
Well, that you know, wonderful idea for students at the University of California won't exactly work for a family of five.
Right. Thank you so much for joining us today. I hope you have a wonderful, wonderful time teaching physics for future presidents.
I do. It's a great pleasure.
And
thank you very much.
You're welcome, and good luck with your book.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Goodbye, Dr. Mueller. This is brilliant. I love the fact that...
Dr. Richard Mueller, you can find him at UC Berkeley. You can find him on iTunes or on YouTube with Physics for Future Presidents, which is a free online... they've put his lectures online for free and teach you all about the physics that you might need to know if you wanted to be a president or not.
Even if you don't want to be president, it's nice to know physics. Thank you, everyone, for having listened to our show today.
Thank you so much. Let's see. Shout-outs today go to Ed Dyer. Thank you so much for all the stories you sent in. Bjorn Brems, Todd Kelly. He sent a story that I'll hopefully get to. Gord McLeod, Tony Steele, Naomi Most for all your help. Ryan Bradley, Georgis Kalidasa, Paul Fisher, Michael Johnson, Angela Heinz, who maybe wants to be a Twist tributor at some point.
She may be one of the, we're going to have a co-host, Minion co-host in a couple episodes.
Great. Minion co-hosts. Lars, David Eckerd, Sharon McNicholas, Logan Waterman, Patrick Ford, Robert Hinckley. Thank you all so much for writing in with the story suggestions, with your comments, everything. Looking forward to opening up the Minion mailbag in a couple of weeks here, but possibly next week we will be... That next week is September 1st, right?
Is it?
It is.
Is that already?
I cannot believe how quickly it goes. But we're possibly going to be talking with... Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Yeah!
Yeah, but we only get like 10 minutes. So we really have to figure, he's only free for 10 minutes.
He cannot be that busy saving the world every day.
I know, we're just a little baby radio show to him, I think. So anyway, for more information on anything you've heard here today, show notes will be available on our website, twist.org, with links to the stories and... comments. We want to hear from you. Email us at kirsten@thisweekinscience.com or justin@thisweekinscience.com.
Or you can check out our Twitter handles, which are @JacksonFly or @DrKiki.
That's right. And if you're emailing us, make sure to put twists in the
subject
line. Anywhere
in the subject, because otherwise you get spam filtered into oblivion.
That's right. And we will be back here on KDVS next Tuesday, I believe.
I think it's next Tuesday.
8:30 a.m. 8:30 a.m. Pacific time, and we hope that you will join us again for more great science news, regardless of where you are in the world.
Happy birthday, Aaron Dunning. If you've learned anything from today's show, remember,
it's all in your head.
So, we're experiencing technical difficulties.
Yeah, the CD player just...
It appears as though the radio station is in full revolt at the moment.
Here's our last song. No.
No, it is. That's clear.
No,
that's
not
me disclaimering again.
Song.
That's the beginning of the show. We're going backwards in time, Kirsten. It worked.
I don't know what's going on.
We're traveling
it's
backwards
broken.
In time. I have
it's
no
broken.
Idea what's happened thus far, but I know what the future is. The future is going to be it's going to be music. I know this. I know what's coming next. Does it even matter what happened before if I know what's coming next?
This week in science. This week in science. This week in science. This week in science, it's the end of the world. So I'm setting up shop, got my banner unfurled. It says the scientist is in, I'm gonna sell my advice. Show them how to stop the robots with a simple device. I'll reverse global warming with a wave of my hand. And all it'll cost you is a couple of grand. This week science is coming your way. So everybody listen to what I say. I use the scientific method for all that it's worth. And I'll broadcast my opinion all over the earth. Cause it's This Week in Science.
This Week in Science.
This Week in Science. 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 This Week in Science.
This Week in Science.
This Week in Science. 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 I've got one disclaimer and it shouldn't be news. That what I say may not represent your views, but...